This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, I'm Rachel. Welcome to those of you who haven't been here yet, and welcome back to those who have been with us for the last 2 weeks. In the first week, we looked at sort of an overview of my grandfather's philosophy of halacha. And then last week, we looked at how that practically played out in his view and understanding of the status of women within Judaism. And this week, we're going to look at another test case, another really prime example of what he considers to be a halachic problem, how the halachic process should work, and that is the question of conversion and how should the Jewish people deal with conversion in the modern day. And I think that this is really a terrific example of him speaking out and being courageous in a way that I wish more people did, and I wish there were voices that said the things I hope you'll hear tonight. And this is really an example of a need of the time, something that a new issue facing the Jewish people today. Which I'm going to explain what that means. Obviously, we've had converts throughout history, but what's new about that? So there's a human need, a social reality that's new, and then my grandfather speaking from a place of his understanding of his Torah values, ethics, and morals. So those are all sort of the prime ideas that we saw last time. If you flip to the back, I just didn't have way light out. At the very, very end on the back, I just showed you some of his things that he's written on conversion. So you can see, like with women, it was something that he had been thinking about, and he wrote a number of things. There's an unpublished piece that we're going to look at parts of, which is a suggested platform of unity on conversion according to halacha. And parts of that were then reworked into different things. There was an article that appeared in the periodical Judaism called Conversion According to Halacha, What Is It? That was in 1974. Then that was reprinted in his book. It's a chapter in his book, In Crisis of Faith. Then there's another article called Conversion and the Decline of the Oral Law, which I don't actually fully understand where it was first printed, but it was reprinted, and then in the new book that was Essential Essays on Judaism, which we put out, the family put out after his death. These are things written in English that speak to the problem and have some halacha, but he also wrote an entirely Hebrew article in a halachic Israeli journal called Sinai, which is Birurim B'dinei Gerut, which solely goes through the issues at play in halacha, the Rishonim, the codes, how he understands it from a purely, like if you read the article, it just a halachic analysis of it. It has a little bit of a hint of where he wants to go. And then once again in his book, Not in Heaven, which is the nature and function of halacha, in the section on halacha in our times, he has a chapter on conversion, or a section on conversion. So you can see, like with the issue of women, this is something that he really felt was a glaring and important issue facing the Jewish people in the modern time, and he constantly wrote about it. Okay, so what is the issue facing the Jewish people? As we said, obviously Jews have been converting for years. The issue that he felt was the fragmentation that was happening to the Jewish people based on the different denominations' views and understandings of the way a non-Jew should convert to Judaism, and the lack of agreement on what those basic tenets were. And therefore, it created this issue or problem. You don't hear it so often anymore, but I feel it was like a phrase like, who is a Jew? Do we still say that? I feel like there was like a while back where you heard it all the time. Who is a Jew? And that different groups assume different people to be halachically Jewish. And this fragmentation that he felt in the Jewish people was deeply troubling to him. So we're going to read here the problem. And I think this harks, for people who are with us the first time, for the first time, this really sort of delineates what he thinks a halachic problem is. He says, how to convert to Judaism is not a halachic problem. It is all stated clearly in the Shulchan Aruch, right? Like what you need to do, that's not the problem. The problem is that in this case, the prescribed laws on conversion are in conflict with another important principle of Judaism, that of preserving the unity of Israel. The idea of Knesset Israel through the obligation of Ahavat Israel, the love for the people of Israel. So he sees that there's a conflict. He says there's some specific laws written in the Shulchan Aruch about how to convert to Judaism. And then there's these other values and ideals, which he does not explain to you how he knows. Later on, he might say a little bit that these are Torah ideals. I mean, obviously, they're words that you've heard, Ahavat Yisrael, Achdut, Knesset Yisrael, but he just assumes that you agree with him that these are core values that we have. Only when we understand this have we raised the halachic question. For indeed, such is the classical halachic problem, that the strict adherence to one law is in conflict with the strict adherence to another obligatory principle of Judaism. In the case at hand, any Orthodox Jew has the right to say that for him, the importance of the laws of conversion are so vital that for their sake he will push aside all the important obligations regarding the idea of unity of Israel and love of Israel. But where does he find the authoritative basis for his decision? In the Shulchan Aruch in the section on conversion? Certainly not. There he will find all the rules on how to convert a non-Jew. What he will not find there is the answer to our problem of halakha, i.e. in the view of the importance of the idea of the unity in Israel and all that involves. So this is very interesting because if you remember in what we read before, sometimes he would quote, like, where did Hillel find the idea to make a pruzbah? And it was always for, where did he, when someone is making a halachic innovation, where did they get that idea from? And he would say they got it from within themselves. Right here, he's arguing that the choice that an Orthodox Jew might make to value the strict letter of the law of conversion versus trying to find a unifying position is also an individual choice that that person is making, because in the Shulchan Aruch, it doesn't tell you to make that choice. Right? For Judaism, according to the Torah, what should be our attitude to the vast number of fellow Jews who do not observe the laws of conversion as we do? Where then will he find the answer to his question? In which book? In which code? In no book, in no code. He must make this decision by himself, in his own Jewish conscience. But how so? He will accept the authoritative validity of the law on conversion, and at the same time he will acknowledge the importance of the unity and love of Israel. He will then seek resolution of the conflict from within the comprehensive ethos of Judaism, from what Judaism is about in its totality, according to his understanding and commitment. Right, so now he's saying, right, this choice that you have to make between, or a choice or how you're going to maneuver through this problem is not something you're going to find written. It's something that you have to take from within yourself, right, which is an idea that we saw in many of the texts we read. Moreover, this is an understanding and commitment which has grown into a measure of maturity as the result of the dedicated study of the classical sources of Judaism and of adherence to a way of life inseparable from it, right? This is what he said. This understanding comes from Torah learning and living a Torah lifestyle. This is not purely subjective. This is not purely a subjective decision, but just because of the subjective element involved in it, it will be a truly halachic solution to a genuinely halachic problem, right? It's not going to be purely subjective, but because there is an element that a human being has to decide something, that to him is truly finding a halachic solution to a halachic problem, right? It isn't just opening up, okay, you convert to Judaism, you need a go to the mikvah, maybe you need brit milah, you need to go have a quarter of three, right? Those are written in the Shulchan Aruch. But to grapple with the problem that he sees, that there's a fragmentation in the Jewish people, and his understanding that that must be solved is something that someone is going to have to decide within themselves. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to see his proposal of how to deal with it. Part of what he's going to say is going to be philosophically or theologically or and just also human to human, how Orthodox Jews and rabbis should think of the leaders of the other denomination. And part of it is going to be a practical halachic plan. So it's going to have two parts. And when I say practical halachic plan, towards the end, we're going to look at this sort of unpublished piece that he wrote, which my understanding was actually a live and real transdenominational Beitin that existed in Denver. If anyone's here from Denver and can tell the story of it, we'll talk about that a little bit at the end. So it's not, this is not just something on paper and an ideal. It also had a practical outcome. Okay. In Not in Heaven, he describes what he expands on what he sees this problem is. He said, one of the most serious problems of our day is the widespread ideological fragmentation within the Jewish people. The religious ideologies are numerous. Yet Judaism, in its very essence, is not sectarian, but a way of life of a people. Indeed, it can be fully realized only by a people. To work for Jewish unity in the spirit of Avat Yisrael, love for every Jew, in the interest of Klal Yisrael, the reality of the totality of the Jewish people is an urgent demand of Torah realization. Right, so this is very interesting, right? His understanding is that the whole purpose of Torah and the Jewish people is to be one people, is to be unified around Torah. And so that fragmentation and sectarianism and breaking into small groups is not really what the Torah wants, because the Torah was given to a people. It is to be regretted that halacha, as it is understood today, rather than contributing its share to the striving for Jewish unity, only deepens and fortifies the fragmentation. Okay, so that's a pretty strong statement. Right? His view is that halakha should be working to unify, and at the moment he sees halakha as fragmenting. Right? And his purpose, his understanding is the fundamental purpose of halakha should be to preserve this Torah view, that we want one unified people. Okay, so now we're going to get a little bit to what the task at hand is and how this is going to play out. Part of, you have to listen to very carefully to what he's saying, because he's speaking two voices at once that are both important. There's going to be a refrain over and over again, and you're going to understand why he says this, of how orthodox he is. He is orthodox, he believes in the values of orthodoxy, we Orthodox Jews, and it's very important for him to state that he is orthodox. On the other hand, the other things that are going to be coming out of his mouth, at least from what I hear Orthodox rabbis say today, are not going to sound very orthodox to a certain extent. So listen carefully. He said, it is our conviction that halakha has to be stretched to its limits in order to further Jewish unity and to better mutual understanding. Okay, so he is going to show, he believes that he has to stretch halakha to its sort of breaking point. We're going to see what he means by that, because we want to have Jewish unity and mutual understanding. In the Orthodox camp, there are certain psychological impediments that have to be overcome. It is time that Orthodox rabbis face without dogmatism the issue of their relationship to rabbis of the non-Orthodox denomination. Right, and this is like, it's so sad to be reading this, because today what's going on in Israel and some of the statements that have been made about the other denominations are frighteningly sad compared to what he's suggesting. Judged in the light of the real situation, it is just not true that the latter, because of their conservative or reform interpretation of Judaism, are incapable of Yirat Shamayim. So I'll put it out there, he is wanting to suggest that there's going to be a joint Beitin and a joint unified platform on conversion, right? For that, in his discussion of understanding, can we accept Reform and conservative rabbis as part of this, as even Dayanim, he's going to use the word, is a main question of how do I think of their religious belief, right? If I think of them as not believing anything similar to me and not believing in Judaism the way I think, I'm clearly not going to want to accept their authority. And at the core basis of this is, do I think that they have fear of heaven? Do I think that they're living a life that is in relationship with the divine? And he says, it's just not true if you assume that they can't have Yirat Shamayim. To insist that this is so is a prejudice. It is insisting on an untruth that, as such, is a violation of important biblical commandments. Right? He just says, if you say such a thing, it means you're prejudiced, you're not looking, and it's not true, and that is a violation of Torah. There are quite a few among conservative Reform rabbis who are sincere believers in Judaism. Nor should one take it for granted that belonging to the Orthodox group automatically bestows upon one the precious treasure of Yirat Shamayim. That is also a very important line. It is true that some of the practices and teachings of non-Orthodox rabbis represent a violation of the laws of the Torah as they are understood by the Orthodox interpretation. Here, his language is so interesting, right? Understanding, interpretation. But it is not true that they interpret and practice as they do because they mean to perform an act of heresy or rebellion against Judaism. On the contrary, many of them work to preserve, to enrich, to serve Judaism and the Jewish people no less than the best among their Orthodox colleagues. From the point of view of their ideological position, their intention may be no less l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, than that of Orthodox Jews. So this idea, all of you who are sitting in the room who know might say, oh, that's obvious. But this idea is not so obvious to many an Orthodox rabbi, right? To look at someone who behaves differently than you, who understands Torah differently to you, and to be able to understand that what they are doing, they believe is L'shem Shemayim. They believe is for the good of the Jewish people. They believe is... Are there more sources? They believe... You got... Okay. They believe is to benefit the Jewish people's relationship with the divine.
Is he including Haredi among the Orthodox when he says all of this?
I had not thought of it. He doesn't single them out. What did you want to say?
We're talking about 1974, too. So it's a slightly different world.
Yeah. But I think he's lumping all Orthodox together. But I don't know how much he associated with the more to the right. He's in the modern, he was talking about the modern Orthodox. Okay. What? In Chicago, what?
I'm not so sure if we're talking about the phenomenon of Haredim. What existed in 75?
That I was quite young then. I do not know what existed. What is their halachic status? Yep. Do you have questions? What is their halachic status? Since they do not violate the law with the knowledge or intention of violating, but on the contrary with the conviction, however mistaken from the Orthodox point of view, of practicing a valid form of Judaism, they are not to be considered mumrim lahachas, apostates out of spite, nor even mumrim l'te'avon, apostates of convenience. So this is very interesting what's about to happen here. He is trying to figure out how to halachically categorize these other Jews. Now, you might feel a little bit discomfort with this idea, but it's because he wants to think about, can they be on a Beit Din, and can they be kosher le'edu? Can they, from his halachic understanding, can they be eligible to give testimony, to make declarations? And what he is doing here is very important to him, because there are a number of categories that exist within halacha vis-a-vis this issue. Who is kosher le'edut? And obviously someone who is a rasha, whatever exactly that means, but in the Shulchan Aruch is defined as someone who is over aveirot, who transgresses, is not able to give testimony and make a statement, right? The Beit Din needs to make some type of statement that this person has moved from one status to another and have the authority to do that. So he doesn't use the word rasha here, but anyone who knows the halakha of what he's talking about, in the back of their minds might be thinking, I, an Orthodox Jew, might perceive their practices as violation of the Torah, and they might be in the category of rasha. And then we even have people who are apostates who do things out of spite, or who do things because they have a desire and they're attracted to certain behaviors that they can't control. These two categories of people are also not able to be considered edin. So he doesn't want you to categorize any of them in those situations. But listen to what he does say. From a halachic point of view, they are toim, mistaken. This reference to non-Orthodox rabbis as toim, as erring ones, should not be taken as a form of condescension. We are attempting to define their status from the point of view of halacha. I fully realize that non-Orthodox interpreters of Judaism may similarly refer to the Orthodox interpretation as ta'ut, a mistake. Ideological differences should not be watered down, but neither should they destroy the respect that we owe each other, nor should they erode our sense of responsibility to work for the unity of Israel to the ultimate limit of our ideological positions permit. So this is a fascinating statement, right? He wants them to be halachically called to'eh, because to'eh just means I've made a mistake, that I've done a behavior out of mistake, right? And in the Shulchan Aruch, in the halachot of Edut, in Choshen Mishpat, there the Ramah says very clearly, it's a case of people who bury the dead on the first day of Yom Tov, that the Mechaber, Rav Yosef Kar, says they're kasher le'edut. And the Rama adds to that and says that hahu adin b'shar devar isur, that refers to also other types of behaviors that are forbidden. Shenochal lomar shavro mikoch ta'ut, that we could say that they transgressed out of a mistake. The case there, people buried, they thought it's appropriate to bury the dead. They thought they were doing something right when they did it, and so if you do something wrong but with the right intentions, that's called mistaken, and it doesn't take you out of the category of being able to testify. And so that is the halachic category that my grandfather wants to use for the other denominations who behave and think differently. He doesn't want you to think that he's saying something not nice and nasty about them. He admits, this to me is unbelievable, to be like an understanding of what the other is, that they might well say the same thing about him and his behaviors and his beliefs, and that's okay, right? It's okay to disagree. The question is, can we talk to each other? Can we work with each other? And from this point where I might think your behavior is not how I want to be, and you might think my behavior is not how I want to be, but how can we move forward? And so he is using the concept of the fact that they are really Yerei Shamayim, but they are making some mistakes, to enable them to possibly serve on a Beit Din. That's the motivation for what he is talking about here. And his overall goal is this language of having respect and working together even when one disagrees. So far, so good? Any questions so far?
No, yeah. It's just jumping out that it's so reminiscent of Hillel and Shammai, of the kinds of, you know, the model of respect for the difference and marrying each other's families.
Yes and no, in the sense that however it played out in our ancient history, Hillel and Shammai were still considered part of the same community to a certain extent, right? Shammai's behavior hadn't taken them out of the community, and Hillel's behavior vis-a-vis Shammai hadn't taken them out of the community. The place that the Jewish people is in today, I don't think that all the different groups in all different directions necessarily think and respect each other in the same way, right? Meaning, I don't mean to water down Hillel and Shammai. They're beautiful models. But in some ways, it's like a group, you know, so I wait 3 hours, you wait 6 hours. I'll open a bottle on Shabbat, you won't. But we're still part of, like, we have fundamental differences. Well, those, I don't know if those are fundamental differences. But there's fundamentally different ways. But there's different ways of interpreting halacha, and we're part of, I think that maybe you could say, like, modern orthodoxy and ultra-orthodoxy are like a Hillel and Shammai today. I don't know. I think that the break that has happened between the Orthodox and some of the other denominations is a much, right? I don't, if we can't find a way to solve the issue of conversion, we're not going to be able to marry each other. And that is where this is why this is such a burning issue. This is why it's such a burning issue. Yes.
Is this all before the decision on patrilineal descent?
Yeah. Someone tell me the yes. Yes. What's the year of patrilineal descent?
This is before the 80s.
It's also before the ordination of women, when someone will start to ask me about women. I don't know when patrilineal descent. I don't know if there's a nafka mina for that. What would be the difference?
In terms of the... They could serve as a dean, that wouldn't be the issue, but in terms of the consequences for unity of the people.
Ah, you're saying, what if one of the people on the Beit Din was not perceived to be halachically Jewish by the other people? That is interesting. Okay, hold that for the end, then ask me that again. It's definitely before. It's definitely before. Hold that thought. I hadn't thought of that. Hold it and bring it up at the end again, because I want to think about it.
Well, I just wanted to ask you if, you know, like you said, this seems to be an extremely liberal attitude towards the non-Orthodox denominations, especially in light of what's going on today. But so was this a prevalent attitude, or did he have a lone, what do you call it? Was he, you know, alone in this attitude, or were...
I think he was pretty alone. I mean, I was going to say this later, but I'll say it now. The Gedolim that existed in the time, right? Rav Moshe Feinstein has a response about it's about marriage, but he says explicitly that conservative conversion is meaningless. Even his teacher, the Sri Dei Eish, has two different shuvot related to liberal Judaism. This is pre-World War. To a case of, can you bury converts convert through the liberal movement in the Jewish cemetery. He doesn't like it, but he says to the rabbi, don't make a big deal, but if they get buried, tell your Orthodox congregants to bury 8 amot away from them. I think the Sridi Yeshua was very much bothered by the fact, I don't know, I didn't check this historically, that in Germany there were a lot of converts just for marriage, and they went through the liberal, we're going to talk about converts just for marriage a little, we'll touch on it. And they went through the liberal movements, and he was disturbed by the numbers. I don't know if they were so high, but that's what I understand. He has another, the Sridi Yeshua has another response, could a Moel circumcise the son of one of these female converts? And he actually says no, because if you circumcise him, then people will think he's a Jew, and they'll forget that he's really not a Jew. So this is his teacher who is saying some very strong statements against. And I can imagine, I think there were others who felt this way. And the question is, what changed? I think that what changed, I mean, I don't know when Rav Moshe wrote that. I know that the Sridi Yeshua was writing at before the war. I think my grandfather really felt that we'd reached this point of that such fragmentation that he was really worried about what the future of the Jewish people is going to be and how is it going to play out. And he's going to talk about thinking of this as an Eitz Tzorech, a time of need, or a Shatat Chak, a pressing hour. That to go this other way of fragmentation wasn't what he felt would be the right thing. But he definitely was a lone voice, I think. Yes.
In the 70s, yeah. The conservative conversion was still mikvah and kavlat omitz.
I believe in the 2016s it still is.
So many
conservative conversion for sure. Yeah.
So what is the objection of who the Adim are or who the Beit Din is? What's the
objection? Well, I think it's a few things. One is the reform movement at a time, but now they've swung back, did not require mikvah.
I know.
Great. So he's actually going to explicitly say in a moment, or not in a moment, in a few moments, that he doesn't think there's such a distinction with conservative Jews, but it's more with reform Jews. I think it has to do with this question of what do you think their belief system is and how that plays out in their behavior. That's thing number one. So if you think something about the quality of the judges have to be a certain way, that's going to be questionable. And the second thing is if you assume what the requirements are. So let's say we could get people to agree on mikvah and mila, on dunking and circumcision, which is going to be a red line that he won't cross. But the question is also, what does it mean to accept the yoke of mitzvot? So that is the big question. What does that mean? And that's what he's going to talk about, right? So if you just take ideological, you know, policy line, an Orthodox view of what acceptance of a mitzvot is going to be different than a conservative one and is different than a reform one. And that is, and so if you believe that in their baiting what they're requiring to do is not what you would require, then you think that they maybe haven't completed the conversion process, if I explain that clearly. Okay. I want to show you one other very interesting thing that it's fascinating that he has the understanding of others, sensitivity to say. So this is on page 3. It was so difficult to me because I think he says things so well that I kind of feel a little silly that I'm just sitting here reading out loud his words, but I just love his words, so that's what we're doing. Although I guess if it was Hebrew text, I wouldn't feel so bad, but for some reason, because it's English, I feel funny just reading it out loud to you. So he says, this is from the article that was originally in Judaism and then he reprinted in Crisis in Faith. The din, the law regarding conversion, is really very simple. For a conversion in accordance with the din, right, with the law, there has to be kabbalat mitzvot, the acceptance of the commandments of the Torah. In the case of a male convert, there has to be circumcisions. And for both men and women, there has to be tefillah, immersion, and a ritual bath. Right? So that's, he thinks, for him, that's a simple understanding. The requirement of the law in this matter is clear. There is no problem here. The problem, of course, he's restating the problem, is that while there is a din as stated in the Talmud and crystallized in the code, there are also a great many Jews who either do not accept the Talmud as the ultimate authority of their own religious conscience, or who give the law regarding conversion an interpretation which differs widely from the one given to it by Orthodox Judaism. The real question, therefore, is what does the Shulchan Aruch say about conversion? That is well known. The question is what to do about all the Jews who do not accept the Orthodox view in this matter. And this is very interesting what he says. It makes little sense to argue that since the unity of the Jewish people is at stake, all Jews must accept the Orthodox viewpoint. It makes no sense at all. Not because the question of conversion is not that important. It is of vital importance to us all. We are dealing here with the very essence of the nature and meaning of Jewishness. It makes no sense because in this way we shall not safeguard the unity of the Jewish people. So this is a fascinating thing because I think many people assume that the only way you can preserve anything is like, what's it called, the lowest, firmest common denominator? What is it? No, but then they take lowest common denominator and they turn that into firmest common. No, isn't there some play on that? So he assumes that many a person would say, well, because it's so important, we have to just stick by our guns and hold to what he's doing. On the contrary, the gap widens and the essential nature of being a Jew becomes more and more diluted for more and more Jews. One might perhaps retort, we are not concerned with the practical consequences. Here is the law. We insist that it be adhered to. But would this still be a halachic position? Is it indeed so that authentic halacha is free of meaningful practical considerations? His answer clearly is no. You can't just live in a bubble. It has to have practical considerations. Apart from the practical considerations, there is also the moral question. Listen to what he perceives to be a moral question. This is actually, I just boggled my mind when I read it. To be considered. By insisting that in matters of conversion, the Orthodox view must prevail exclusively, we have, of course, stated that our rather numerous non-Orthodox brothers and sisters have to be excluded from having any say in such a vital issue as what it means to be a Jew. Do we have the moral right to make such demands? Right? So his assumption is, how can we possibly say to other Jews, you have no say in what it means to be a Jew? Right? He looks at it as a moral problem. Then listen to how he frames it. It is true that we maintain the Torah is Mina Shemayim, revealed to the Jewish people by God, and therefore the law regarding conversion has divine authority. I too believe that, together with all Orthodox Jews. Nevertheless, I cannot overlook the fact that no matter how strongly I believe it, it is still only my personal belief. And if there are tens of thousands of us who so believe, the faith in Torah Mina Shemayim will still remain our faith. No matter how convincing our reasons and our proof for this faith may be for us, they will still be no more than reasons and proofs for us. Enough for me, clear and convincing like the brilliance of the clear and cool morning, yet inseparable from my subjectivity. It is true that our opinion in this matter of conversion is identical with that of Gedolei Torah and great Torah sages of our generation. But again, this too is our recognition of their greatness. If we should be mistaken, if the great Torah scholars themselves should be mistaken, then the greatness of the Gedolim itself would be wanting and of little consequence. But of course we are right. Our faith is true, and the greatness of the great ones is unquestionable. Indeed, so we believe. That Torah is Mishmaim, so I believe, but I cannot help recognizing that the fact that I so believe does not make my belief a faith Min HaShemayim. The Torah is Min HaShemayim. My faith that it is so is not. Neither is my interpretation of the meaning and the consequences of that faith Min HaShemayim. If so, how can we deny to conservative and reform rabbis and scholars to the right to their interpretations? Of course, we Orthodox are the only true, only Torah true Jews. But no matter how much we insist on this, it will nevertheless remain our own subjective insistence. Could not then our non-Orthodox brothers and sisters turn to us and say with equal right, since our interpretation of Torah and Judaism is mistaken, that we do not represent Torah true Judaism and that only theirs is the Torah true way? Right? This is the fact that he could even think about this fact, right? So here, on the one hand, he's constantly saying, I'm Orthodox, I believe in Torah Mina Shemayim, this is the true Jew, this is the true faith. On the other hand, he sees that he admits that that is subjective. Right, Torah is Min HaShemayim, but that my faith is so is not Min HaShemayim, which is a lovely dichotomy that he is willing to hold. And he acknowledges that they could be thinking the same thing about us. And therefore, he it's fascinating to me that I would have never thought to call this a moral question. How can we deny them the right to have a say in this matter as well? They're part of the Jewish people. This is a central issue to the Jewish people, and we have to work with them. Here's the last paragraph. Of course, an Orthodox Jew might say, I don't care what they maintain. I have my own convictions, and I shall not depart from the law regarding conversion in the Shulchan Aruch, right? Kechut asara, not as much as a breath of a hair. Indeed, one does have the right to such a decision. But for the sake of intellectual honesty, one should have a proper understanding of the meaning of such a decision. In a sense, in its ultimate consequences, this would be a decision to secede from the community with non-Orthodox Jews or to exclude them from the community with us. Or, to say the least, it would be a decision regarding the rights and status of our non-Orthodox brothers and sisters within the community of Israel. However, if this is fully understood, we will have to concede that this is no longer a question purely of conversion, but of the importance of the unity of the Jewish people, the idea of Klal Yisrael, in relationship to the laws of conversion. Okay, so here he is saying, if you're honest and you have a proper understanding, right, this line was so fascinating to me, right, the Orthodox Jewry is seceding from then. Usually we think they're leaving Judaism, we think, I don't know who you are. Orthodox Jewry says they're leaving, right, we're here where we're supposed to be and they're leaving. His view is, if we behave this way, we're going to leave them. We're not going to be with them. Yes?
I just wonder, if the non-Orthodox are the majority,
yes,
they will say the Orthodox don't belong to the Jewish people.
He admits that they might say that.
Yeah, you know, so we will exclude you. Right?
I don't know who the we is in that sentence. We non-Orthodox,
we non-Orthodox
would exclude.
Will exclude you Orthodox, yes? What would happen then? Nothing, I suppose.
I think that's what he's worried about. That's what he's worried. He does not want that to happen. He understands that everyone could, like, build their fortress and be inside of it and say, we're the true Torah Jews, and you're mistaken, and you're off doing what you believe, and we'd be... Yes, that could happen as well. And his point is, if you have intellectual honesty and you take your head out of the book, that would be the consequence, and in his mind, that can't possibly be the consequence. He does not want us to be so fragmented, and so he is going to suggest some solutions. But before he suggests that, he admits and he understands how difficult this would be for this. He understands that this is extraordinarily difficult for Orthodox Jews. So this terrible type up is because. It's a scan of this copy that says copy all over it that I don't know if it ever got printed in any way besides the copy. And the scan is bad because my uncle scanned it and it didn't stand so well. I mean, it's not his fault. I think the typing was bad. But so this is what you're reading from. With my grandfather writing in the Hebrew because his typewriter didn't type in Hebrew letters. Probably the most difficult aspect of the problem of unity is the requirement that Orthodox rabbis recognize non-Orthodox rabbis as qualified to form their own Beit Din for the purposes of conversion. It is probably here where the highest measure of boldness in the exercise of Avat Yisrael is demanded. Right? So he knows that this is difficult. Right? This will be the most highest measure of boldness if you want to truly believe in Ahavat Yisrael. And he says that's in one part. He says in another part, the most challenging part of the mutual recognition, which is required by this platform of unity, falls to the consciences of Orthodox rabbis, whether they are able to accept conservative reform colleagues as possessed of sufficient Yirat Shemayim to enable them to act as Dayanim. Right? And then he goes on to say, don't they follow practices from the Orthodox point of view, which are considered, and I cannot read that word, if anyone could read it, sheker? It doesn't look like a resh at the end. Something that is a negative Hebrew word. I have...
Yes.
Sheket? You think it's Sheket? I don't know what the word is. But so he understands that this is really difficult, that it challenges a lot, but he still thinks that we have to go for it. Okay? And this is his plan. Here's the plan. He says the following. We have our own views on what constitutes genuine conversion, and you have, this is what he would say to his non-Orthodox colleagues, and you have yours. We agree on this point. Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you're listening. This is what I have this problem every time. A, I never was a good reader. And B, it's late at night. We disagree on this point. We shall not force our view on you, and you will not force yours on us. But insofar as we are both part of Knesset Israel and desire to have our place of responsibility within it, we do have in common our concern for the preservation of Kal Yisrael and are equally motivated by Avat Yisrael. Therefore, in this matter of conversion, your problem is very similar to ours. It is not really a question of how to admit a non-Jew to Judaism. It is a halachic problem for you no less than us, i.e. how to resolve the conflict between your requirements for conversion and your commitment to the reality of Kal Yisrael. We know well that your lechatchila. We know well what your lechatchila position on conversion is, but since this is a case of eight hatzorach and shat hatzchak, what would be your bidiavad position in view of the needs of the Jewish unity for the sake of your love of your fellow Jews? Okay, so he's using Hebrew terms, but this is his premise. His premise, and he's going to say it a few other times. We'll see it from the Orthodox point of view. In halacha, there's always my ideal. My lechatchila situation, right? If you ask me before the fact, how do I think halacha should play out in situation X, Y, or Z, I'll tell you this is the ideal. But then a lot of times in certain halacha cases, we have a bidiavad, we have an after the fact, right? This is what's already happened. How does halacha view it? How do we think about it halachically? And our after the fact sometimes is very different than our before the fact, right? If you ask me, should I... if you're Ashkenazi, and you ask me, can I cook my rice in a fleishig pot and then serve it with a milchik meal, right, in a meat pot and then serve it with dairy, I would say, don't do it. But if you already did it, I would say to you, it's okay. Right? There's a difference between the before the fact and the after the fact. So he says, we should look at the halacha about conversion, and there's always going to be the ideal. This is the ideal way a convert should happen. But what if certain things didn't happen? What if there was a Beit Din of people who were not knowledgeable? What if a Beit Din didn't ask or didn't tell them about certain mitzvot beforehand? Does the halacha consider it a valid conversion or not? Right, in those both cases, the answer is going to be yes. And we should say, okay, when you say something b'diavad after the fact is okay, it means that it has to be legally okay. Right, it's not my ideal, but it has to be legally okay. And when do we usually have a b'diavad situation and after the fact situation, right? It's at a time of need, or it's 2 minutes before Shabbos and I realize that I cooked the rice in the milchik pot and I want to serve it with my chicken, right? And that's what I was going to have for my Shabbat meal. So then that's the need. So he wants to look at this whole period in Jewish history as a time of need. This is not our ideal. Our ideal is not that we're broken into different groups that disagree on fundamental issues. So if that's the case, the compromise from the Orthodox side, and we're going to see this specifically in a second, is that the Orthodox should move to their b'diavad, you know, halachic understanding, and bring that to the table. And he's asking the conservative reform. I don't know exactly what their b'diavad would be, right? But to try to say, ideally, if we were on our own, this is what we think. But because we're looking to compromise, we'll do, right? So it could be that it would be something like, the reform movement at a certain point felt you didn't need to go to mikvah. That would be their ideal. They're willing to accept you as a convert if you didn't. But b'diavad, they might be willing to require it if that would keep them in communication, right? And the Orthodox might say, our ideal definition of what accepting mitzvot is will be X. We're going to look at specifically this in a second. But we're willing to step back from what we require so that we can join with you, right? And the question is, what are we going to each bring to the table as sort of like, our position that we're willing to work with because we're interested in working with you. Okay? And so that is what he's suggesting, because it's really a time of need. Right? So what would be your b'diavad position in view of the need for the Jewish unity and for the sake of your love of your fellow Jews? In view of the need and the urgency dictated by our understanding of Judaism's call for Avat Yisrael and the safeguarding of the unity of the community of Israel and our relationship with you, we are b'diavad willing to forgo the demand for full adherence to the requirements of conversion as we accept it for our own conduct. Meaning, Orthodox Jews, if they were just working within an Orthodox system, might have this up here requirement. They're willing to forgo some of them. We're going to see what those are in a second. How far can you go, speaking to the other Jews, in allowing your obligation to preserve the unity and commitment to a common destiny to control and modify your requirements for conversion? This relates now to what you were asking me before. I disagree with Reform Jews as to what these requirements ought to be. I'm on the same page. As to conservative Judaism, I understand from some of its leading spokesmen that the majority of conservative rabbis do adhere to the laws of conversion as stated in the Shulchan Aruch. Although I assume that the Orthodox interpretation as to what constitutes Kabbalat HaMitzvot, the acceptance of commandments, may differ from theirs. But notwithstanding the disagreements, I do have sufficient respect for the leading rabbinical and scholarly personalities in both the conservative and reform groups to know that, in moral responsibility, they could not, would not, refuse to respond positively to such an approach on the part of those who came to them in the name of halakha. At least, instead of shouting at each other, we might start talking to each other. Okay, so that is going to be his premise, that each group should come with their sort of, not their ideal, but their sort of lowest common denominator of what they're willing to forgo. Yes?
Isn't part of the problem with even Orthodoxy, the notion of what Kabbalah Mitzvot means differs quite a lot across the board of Orthodoxy?
Yes, obviously that is true. My grandfather's argument that he's trying to show is he looks in the Hebrew article that he wrote in this is what he did. He looks at the Gemara, he looks at the Talmud, he looks at the Rishonim, he looks at the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and he tries to present, right? Not everyone might agree with him, but he tries to present what he thinks is a solid view that he can argue, this is what our tradition says about this, right? He's not just going to sit in the air and say, like, I'm willing to forgo this. He tries to look and understand, what does Kabbalat Mitzvot mean? When are they willing to accept converts? In what type of situation do we see in the halakha? So what must that mean about accepting, right? That's what he's going to show you some of this right now. So obviously anyone can disagree with him, but I think from his perspective, he's doing something that is solidly rooted within the halakhic texts as he knows them and as he understands them. Yes?
He died before the big Russian immigration, didn't he?
92. So I don't know when the big Russianers are.
Yeah. So it's become not a particularly a religious question. It's a political question.
That's here, not the States.
Yeah.
Well, here too is, when you say a religious, a political question, what do you mean exactly by that? Maybe I'm not understanding the code.
Well, the great amount of families who came with mixed marriages.
Right, but why is that a political issue?
Because you're trying to get the country together. The children of these marriages are going into the army, and
so for him, that's exactly the burning issue. That's the same question. Meaning, if we think that some of these children are not halachically Jewish, and we want them to convert to Judaism. Right, that's the problem. That now the understanding is they have to accept and behave as if they're Orthodox Jews, when we know the vast majority of them are not interested. Yet these people have put their lot in with the Jewish people, right? And so that is exactly that for him is the same halakhic problem that he's disguising here. And it could be an Orthodox Beit Din that should, in his view, I think I can speak clearly on knowing what I think he would say on this, that should hold different standards for that situation, specifically because of the unity of the Jewish people. Because if we continue as we are, then we're living with one nation that functions as a nation in certain things, but then cannot marry one another, like Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Yes, what did you want to
say? I think, if I'm correct in understanding, the political is that the definition by the State of Israel as from Misrata Pnim, for coming back under the law of return, differs from the halakhic definition. So now you're competing, instead of having different ideological views of within a religious spectrum, you're having now a national and a religious definition which differs from each other, and it creates a political...
So it's a similar, I think it's a
right,
similar
I think
problem.
It's still the halakha versus the definition of Klal Yisrael kind of thing is still the thing, but I think it does become politicized outside of specifically religious into a national sense now.
I understand what you're saying. Okay, so he's going to explain what he thinks his b'diavad situation is. So on page 5 right now. He says, though sincerity of motivation is required l'chatchila, right? The convert needs, in our ideal state, the convert needs to be sincere. If one accepts Judaism for a reason of marriage or for other ulterior motives, right? That means non-sincerity, not full sincerity. He is accepted as a Jew, right? This is based on a Gemara and Yavama, based on other three, right? It's not our ideal. We don't want people to just convert for marriage. We want them to be sincere converts. But if this is what happened and why they did it, halakhically, the conversion is valid. Of course, even in such cases, there has to be formal acceptance of Judaism, right? There has to be some type of acceptance. More important, however, is the qualification that the sincerity of motivation is not to be interpreted strictly. There is a story of the Gentile who came to Hillel to be converted on the condition that he be appointed the high priest. This is Gemara and Shabbos. Mm-hmm. Or, right, that's a case, right? And Hillel converts him. Or the case of the woman who asked Rabbi Chiya to be converted in order to be able to marry one of his disciples. That's a Gemara and Menachem. Both were converted. The generally accepted explanation is that one is the one given by Tosfot, that both rabbis were sure that the Gentile involved would ultimately, after the actual conversion, practice Judaism l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. In other words, the sincerity of these converts was not judged purely on the ground of their momentary, consciously realized motivation, but on what was expected to be the outcome in the future. This is a matter to be evaluated in light of the character of the people and the specific situation in which they decide to convert. So this is a very interesting idea. Right? At the moment, the understanding of, let's say, the Rabbanut is, you have to come ready, when you're converting, you have to be at the level that they want you to be, basically, of acceptance of mitzvot and observance. Obviously, you're going to keep learning somewhat, but you're supposed to be already there. Right? Here, he brings a number of cases where people are converting for other reasons, clearly. He's going to come back to the examples of Hillel. Hillel converts in crazy situations. And that it seems to me that the assumption is where I'm going to move to, where I'm going to go in the future, and not where I am now. And I don't know where you're going to go in the future, right? Presumably, the more connected the Jewish people are, the more your commitment to the Jewish people is going to be, however that's going to play out. Okay. Yes?
But if he's already agreed that the acceptance of all mitzvot, let's say, is the interpretation of that is different between the Orthodox.
He's going to discuss that. It's coming. I promise that. It's coming. I promise that's coming. Okay. How he's going to understand all it's coming. It's coming. Right, there's no reason to assume that such an insight into the future development of converts' relationship to Judaism is granted only to Hillel or Rabbi Chiya. So this is an interesting thing, right? We saw that Hillel did it. We saw that Rabbi Chiya does it. His assumption is that that could be us as well, us, the Beit Din today. And indeed, the Beit Yosef derives from these stories the principle that everything depends on the judgment of the court, or their appreciation of where this kind of conversion for some ulterior motive will ultimately lead. Right? If you think she wants to marry a Jew and that's going to be good because ultimately they're going to be attached to the Jewish people, then that's the decision of the court. What these stories and interpretations placed on them mean is that there is no hard and fast rule in these matters. At times it is proper to discourage initially. At others, one should be helpful right at the onset. Right? And then he tells the story in the Talmud of Timna, who Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov didn't want to convert and rejected, right? And the result, the Midrash says, the result was Amalek, the classic enemy of the Jews, was her offspring. Why did this happen? Answers the Talmud, the Gemara and Sanhedrin, they should not have pushed her away, right? And so this question, the court has to have sensitivity, who's coming, what's going to happen, what's our expectations for them. Kabbalat mitzvot is a condition. How do I pronounce it? Sin qua non. There you go. There can be no conversion without it. But nowhere is it spelled out clearly what is meant by the acceptance of commandments. The very term is rather vague. Quite clearly, it is not does not mean the acceptance of all the commandments of the Torah. That the Beit Din, as the Talmud state, has to make known to the converts some of the lighter mitzvot and some of the more different. The kalot and the chamorot, this is what the Gemara says, the Breiter and Yevamot says, you have to make known some of the mitzvot. Proves that it is not even necessary to make known to them all the commandments, which of course would be extremely difficult from a practical point of view. But the term some of the commandments is also extremely vague. Which commandments? How many of them? Some of them are mentioned in the Talmud. But on the whole, once again, the judgment is left to the court. So the ones that are mentioned there in the Gemara and Yevamot are actually leket, shechecha, and peah, and maser ani, like actually the tithes and the our agricultural laws that take care of the poor. I guess that would be pretty important for a convert to know. And I don't know if it's possibly that someone is converting because they want those benefits. So I don't put that out there. Not eating chalev, so something about the dietary laws, and then mention that if you transgress Shabbat, there's a punishment, but no details of what Shabbat is. Does Kabbalat mitzvot then mean the acceptance of the commandments which are made known to the would-be convert, right? So are we to assume whatever they tell them about, that's what we're requiring them to accept? And then he points out that there's a problem with that, because there are situations where if they forget to mention any mitzvot, the convert is still converted, right? If you look in the next paragraph, I won't read it all out, but it is a quote from the Rambam. Hold on.
Yeah.
But I thought he quoted the Rambam directly, but I'm missing it.
He
does?
Yet
Maimonides rules that if a court of laymen, hedyot, neglected to make known to the convert some of the lighter and some of the more difficult commandments, the conversion is valid and binding if he was circumcised and immersed in the mikvah. Right? So the Rambam holds that if, this is two things that are important what the Rambam holds, if they're hedyot, regular lay people, so much so lay people that they forget to mention any of the mitzvot at the time of the conversion. There is mikvah and there is milah. Then the convert is a convert, right? So, and the other halachic authorities agree with this, right? The Shulchan Aruch agrees and everyone agrees with this. So it seems he understands, wait a second, if you don't even have to mention them and you can be converted, that per se doesn't seem to be a correlation between the two. It would seem to us that it's possible to show shabur for the idea in the Talmudic sources, that the abjuring of the former, this is now his definition of what he thinks Kabbalat mitzvot is, the abjuring of the former religion, the acceptance of the faith in one God of Israel, and the joining of the Jewish people are of necessity essential in the intention of becoming a convert and are to be understood by all who move to convert. But even in its form of making known to the convert some of the mitzvot, relatively little as it can be, made known are the entire complex teachings of Judaism and of the life demanded by it. Since Kabbalat mitzvot alone suffices b'diavad and is realized by the abjuring of the former faith, the acceptance of faith in one God of Israel, and circumcision and immersion, it is obviously only the beginning. Okay, that is what he understands. And I know he's just saying it quickly, but I promise you, he does a whole entire halachic article. If you want to read the halachic article in Hebrew, I can send it to you, where he proves that this is what he thinks. You have to separate from your past religion. You have to accept God as the God of the Jewish people and that there is some type of Torah. And that is what accepting of the mitzvot is. All the more, you're going to dislearn. I'm sorry?
He's not saying the God of the Jewish people. He's saying one God.
One God of Israel.
Yeah, the one God of Israel is the one God.
What did you think I meant? I wasn't admitting there were lots of gods. I just meant that there's one God and that God is in special relationship with Israel.
It wasn't clear.
I'm sorry. I didn't even have that you had a hava mita that I was saying something else. That is not what okay. At this stage, the convert cannot have... Yes, sorry.
What's this about a court of laymen? Laymen could serve the place of the Beit Din to convert someone?
Yes. Sure. Yeah. That's what the halacha says. In fact, there is even a machloket, I was going to say this later, about if you need a court. The Rif holds that even if you don't have a Beit Din, if you just have one, it's okay. There's a pasuk in the Torah that seems to imply Beit Din. Most people learn that is an asmachta, and some people say... Ideally, they should be Talmidei Chachamim and Dayanim. B'diavad, they could be lay people, and then there's even a view that you don't even need a Beit Din.
Do they have to be Shomer Mitzvah or something like that?
So he's going to, I promise you he'll say all these things. Okay. I promise, he's going to say what he expects of the court, but I'm going to run out of time, so I'm going to go quickly now.
Sure.
So his main point here is there's certain basics, and the rest you're going to continue to learn. Right? You should go out and learn. Here, if you look, I brought one. This is the last paragraph of the Hebrew. I'm on page 7, right? The last paragraph, it's all halachic, and then he has this sort of idea at the end. He says, Nitan lamod nekudah chashuva nosefet mimaseh ha-ger shabah lifnei Hillel. You can learn an important thing from the case of the convert that came to Hillel. Shrei oto ha-ger haya muchan lekabel al atzmo torah shvechtav aval lo torah shval peh. Right, he said, convert me, I'm willing to accept the written Torah, but not the oral Torah. B'chol zol giro Hillel. And nonetheless, Hillel converted him. He's not willing to accept the oral Torah. והדבר תמוה, שהרי הלכה פסוקה היא שעקום המוכן לקבל על עצמו כל התורה כולה חוץ מדבר אחד אין מקבלים אותו. This is shocking. How could Hillel do this? We have a halakha, a clearly decided law that's mentioned in the Gemara, that a non-Jew that is willing to accept all the Torah except for one halakha, you shouldn't accept them as a kafir. V'im ken ech ger Hillel oto ha'akum sholo kibel al tzmo kol ha'torah shebal peh. So how could it be that Hillel is going to accept someone as a convert who doesn't accept all the Torah? Li'yashev kushi zeh mitchavein Rashi. So Rashi on the Gemara trying to answer this question. And this is what he said. V'samach ha'chokmato shesofo shir aglenu lakabel alav. De'lo dam yaha l'chut midvar achad shelo haya kofer b'torah shebal peh ela shelo haya ma'amin shehi mipi ha'gvura. V'hevel it's crazy. Right? He says it's not comparable to the case where I believe in all the Torah, but I just don't want to do one mitzvah. Right? Because that would be a case I'm an apostate. Like, I accept Torah, but I just refuse to do one. Here the case isn't that I'm refusing. I just don't believe that the Torah Shebal Peh was given with God. Right? It's not that I accept and reject. My belief is different. So what does Hillel say? It's a crazy. Hillel is sure that after you learn, you'll start to believe. Right? He's so confident in the power of Torah and the learning process that he is willing to accept based on what the future learning is. So listen, that was Rashi. That's not my grandfather. V'hinei midivrei Rashi, nuchal la'sik shnei divrim. We can learn two things from Rashi. Ki mash lamdeinu shabal litgarer v'lo kibel atzmo kol ha'torah kulo she'en bekablim otzo. Right, so we learn that if you want to come and you're that is only you're refusing to accept part of it. It's only if you did this tnai because you're actually a kofer. What a kofer is, someone like you actively want to reject God. But if it's just that you don't yet believe and you don't know, that isn't considered that, and it's okay to accept the convert like that. And the second thing that he learns. Hold on, I just lost my pace. Oh, chakofer lo mipi ela rak mishi yodesh ezu mitzvahi mipi agvuran na umikomakam eneratel kabar. And the definition of a kofer is only someone who understands that God gave the Torah but is refusing to accept it. Right? But if I just don't understand that, right? V'ilu b'ofer acher enam nikra kofer klal. But, and so what he's trying to claim is people who come to Judaism and just don't know anything because they haven't yet learned. And they might have different beliefs than you. We don't call them apostates, and it's perfectly okay as the model from Hillel to convert them. That's what he is saying. So this is what. So we're what? You know, but it's if you're rebellious is worse than I don't know and I don't believe. But the person's coming saying I don't believe. I'm not interested. I'm not willing. I don't believe I need to do that mitzvah. Because I don't believe, right? And Hillel's confident that if I accept you and you keep learning, you might go that way. There's a risk involved because you could go the other way, obviously. But he looks at Hillel as a model. I want to get to the main points that everyone is worried about. And I have 10 minutes left. So I'm going to go and then you'll ask all your questions at the end. Okay, so what do we have here? I want to try to say it. Vis-a-vis who could be on the Beit Din. He's talking about his Bia Devout, again in a different situation. I'm still on page 7. And he says, we've established that you can accept someone who has an ulterior motive. And then he says that even if the conversion, in the middle of the paragraph, even the conversion had taken place in the presence of three laymen, ignorant of the laws and teachings of Judaism, the conversion is still valid. Of course, this is allowed only by the avad in the event the conversion has taken place. But as a rule, from the start of the conversion process is not permissible. Okay, and so then he starts to argue that this is his the avad principle. So vis-a-vis this question of having non-Orthodox people on a Beit Din, I didn't bring you everything he wrote, but he says they have to have a faith. They themselves, the rabbanim of the other denominations, have to have a faith in Hashem Elokei Yisrael. That's the phrase he used. God, the God of the Jewish people. They have to have a faith in Torah Min HaShemayim. And that there's a covenant between God and the Jewish people. And then he writes, I should have brought this. He says, no matter what the consequences, otherwise, they derive from their personal theology and lifestyle. So you believe that there's a covenant from the God of the Jewish people. It doesn't matter then that you decide my lifestyle is going to be X or my lifestyle is going to be Y based on that. Right? So it doesn't sound like he expects those rabbanim to fulfill halachic practice the way he does. The other thing that is important to him that is in the back of... Yeah, I didn't read that out loud. I wrote it on my side of the notes because I can show it to you afterwards where he wrote it. The other thing that he wrote in another place that I didn't bring you because I didn't want to have so many pages is he talks about smicha in general, that really today we don't have smicha, anyone, Orthodox rabbis as well, meaning the original smicha going back from David HaMelech through Hillel, it stops after the time period of the Tanaim, and we don't have it. And so, yes, for us, smicha means you're learned, and you've been given authority in a certain area that this person's learned, and they have the authority to answer questions in that. And he quotes a number of places where he says that there's also kinds of smicha where you can give someone the reshut to say, in this area you know enough, and you're okay. And we're no talent reshut ba'alma lema sheru'i ra'ui. For whatever is appropriate is appropriate. And so he also has that in the background of his mind that when he's accepting these people of Beit Din, it's not like he's accepting their smicha as something, some theological statement that I've accepted with other denominational smicha. He thinks in general smicha doesn't mean that much in its original form. And so therefore he encourages anyone who's going to participate on the Beit Din has to learn the halachot of Gerut, seriously. And that's so combined with the Yirat Shamayim. And then he assumes that they're appropriate people to discuss this issue. Okay. One more thing, or two more things here. We'll do it quickly. In his platform, if you want to know what has to happen here, look at the bottom of 8. You could read the top yourself. He says the following. Conversion must be sincere. It has to be undertaken out of conviction. Sincerity and conviction should not and need not be judged dogmatically on their actual strength at the time of conversion. That the Beit Din should bear in mind the measure of the likelihood that the adherence to Judaism on the part of the would-be convert may, in the course of time, deepen and gain more commitment and dedication, or possibly weaken and dissolve. Right? He understands that there's a risk, that if I'm saying we're only at this point in the process, hopefully it's going to go one way, but it could go another way. There has to be Kabbalat HaMitzvot in all cases, meaning, so this is his definition of Kabbalat HaMitzvot, but this is from his suggested practical platform, right? The convert has to abjure radically and forever his previous faith and religion. He has to make his own faith in the one God of Israel, i.e. the one God who not only created heaven and earth, but the one creator who concluded a covenant with the people of Israel and revealed to them his Torah. He enters into complete unity and full identification with the historic and living people of Israel. A male convert has to undergo circumcision, and all converts have to undergo mikvah, right? So he assumes that that's going to be part of the compromise on the other parts. Hoda'at mitzvot, we have shown this is an extremely vague concept, like what we have to tell them about mitzvot is vague. We suggest there be a meaningful minimum introduction into Judaism. Its details to be worked out by the group of rabbis or the representatives who are willing to accept the suggested platform of unity. So the group would get together and sort of define, like, what's the minimum things about Judaism we're going to tell? Each member of the group is entitled to go beyond the minimum introduction, right? There's going to be a minimum, and then if you're from a different community and you're teaching your converts, you can say more. Here's another interesting thing he says. Each member of the group impresses on the convert that no matter how much he learns about Judaism, it's only the beginning. And now it's very hard to read what he wrote, but he's quoting the statement that Hillel said to the convert, right? The convert said, will you convert me on one foot, a different case, right? And Hillel says, basically, the Aramaic of v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, and the rest is a commentary, go and learn, right? Idach pirusha hi zil gmir, that you should go and learn. And so that is, you're teaching the beginning, but everyone who's teaching and educating should be impressing this on the convert. Each member of the group obligates himself to teach only what is demanded by Judaism, but never tell a convert that any mitzvah, which is acknowledged by another member, need not be observed. especially here, the implementation of the principle that you're going to go and learn is essential. So do you understand what he's saying, right? A reformed rabbi would just actively teach what he wants to teach, which include whatever basics we agreed on, but he can never say, oh, and like Hilchot Nida, you don't need to do that. He might never mention Hilchot Nida, but he can't actively choose another thing and don't say it. So it could be, right, it sounds like from the platform that Reform converts might be teaching their own, Orthodox might be teaching their own, and there's some, right? So we have a basic that we agree on. In the thing I read about the Denver community, it was Shabbat. It was lighting candles, which was a bit funny to me. It was some concept of Shabbat, lighting candles, fasting on Yom Kippur, and being connected to a synagogue. It was very minimal what they seemed to have agreed on. Okay, what is my last thing that I want to end with?
Denver?
I'm sorry? In Denver. In Denver. In between 1970s, where did I write it down now? Between 1977, you don't have it written, but I thought I wrote it in my notes. Between 1977 and 83, 750 converts were converted in Denver by a joint Beit Din that basically followed this platform. However, very sadly, in 1983, the Orthodox, it was like kind of hush-hush, and then people found out about it, and then, of course, there was some pressure on the Orthodox community to stop. This is what was...
When was it again?
77, 83.
Okay.
6 years, 750 converts.
83 was the passing of the CCAR rule of patrilineals.
Oh, so maybe that links right there with that. So I don't know. So we'll come back to that. But I'll just read you what Harold Jacobs, president of the Orthodox America Council of Young Israel, responded about why they have to secede. We have no point, maybe it's because of this. Actually, in what I'm reading, doesn't say that it had to do with the patrilineal. It says, we have no choice but to draw the line clearly as to who is a Jew and who is not, as to what limits and basic standards of elementary Jewish identity and personal conduct we must insist on. It's time that Orthodoxy put the rest of the Jewish community on notice. No longer will Jewish unity be brought at the expense of Jewish identity. For Klal Yisrael today, it is too high a price. So at a certain point, the Orthodox rabbis chose to disagree with my grandfather and say that Klal Yisrael was not at the point. What they believe in Jewish unity, what they believed is Jewish identity, so maybe now you've explained this more to me, was too important. Agudat Yisrael also said, while compromise for the sake of unity can often make good sense, when dealing with basic principles of faith, compromise is actually a sellout. It is time that all Orthodox rabbis recognize that Reform and Conservative Judaism are far, far removed from Torah, and Klal Yisrael is betrayed, not served, when Orthodoxy enters into religious association with them. As far as the experiment being tried elsewhere, the Observer warned that, quote, other communities contemplating this type of interdenominational cooperation ought to take note of the often pitfalls involved and step back from the abyss. So although it works for a while, maybe it reached a breaking point, and people then spoke out very, very strongly against the idea. I'll read two last statements and then we'll end if you're on the last page. Two things that my grandfather wrote. This is the last paragraph in one of the articles. He says, in the past, because it was a time to act for God, shackles had to be placed on the Oral Torah in violation of God's command. Meaning, at one point in Jewish history, we had to write down the Oral Torah because of Et La'asot L'Hashem. So now the hour has come when the need to act for God places upon us the responsibility to free the Oral Torah from its shackles. In obedience to God's original command, there are risks involved in such an undertaking. Because of it, we need not less, but more fear of heaven. But possibly most of all, we need more love of all of Israel to illuminate our love of Torah and to pray to God for his guidance. So that was one ending. And the ending of the conclusion of the suggested plan, he says, I fully appreciate that from a purely practical point of view, there is little hope that at this stage, the suggestion for the platform of unity suggested here will be acceptable to the generality of the established denominations among us. I believe, however, that an important step towards a greater unity will be made should a significant number of rabbis of all denominations be able to accept the suggested platform of unity. Now listen to his last line. After a great deal of heart searching, And to the best of my knowledge, I have stated what I consider to be halachically possible and necessary, and what thus becomes an inescapable halachic responsibility. And I think this really typifies the main point that I've been trying to say to you the whole time, right? For my grandfather, his belief in the power of the halachic system and that it should be able to meet the needs of the Jewish people was at such a core that when he thought that something was halachically possible, he felt that it was his halachic responsibility to speak about it. Because for him, not only is that Ava Yisrael, but it's really, it's Ava, Torah Yisrael, and truth in the power and validity and eternity of Torah. And so despite the fact, I mean, at one of the lectures, people said, like, what do people think of him? When did he get pushed aside? I think this is a good example, one of the good examples of where his voice was a lone voice and ultimately got rejected. But he felt that he had to speak out once because he felt of his strong beliefs in Torah. Next, you can answer next week, pilot for next week. We're going to talk about another issue of greater pain, which is the issue of Agonot. Which also he was somewhat of a very much a lone voice, but also felt the need to speak out because of its importance. Yes, what did you want
to ask? Still alive when this attempt to do it in Denver fell apart. Did he say anything about that?
Not that I know, but I actually asked my uncle just yesterday what he knew about Denver, and he didn't know. He knew it had happened, but he didn't know anything. I don't know. I know that, you know, here in Israel for many years, the Ne'eman Commission, was trying, what is it called, the commission, worked for years trying to think of some unified platform for conversion, and they, from my understanding, that they used this somewhat as a basis and were working, trying to work with this. As we all know, eventually it fell apart, and sadly, after many years of work, did not succeed, and it's still a major problem facing the Jewish people today in a big way. And so we have the question of the fragmentation of the denominations, and we have the question of Russian Jewry, and sadly, we're going to be reaching a point where there's a major conflict between if we can marry each other or not. Yes?
I work with a man who is involved with a Haredi community where is facing this problem for the first time because of the number of Balei Tshuva who become Haredi and their ancestors or parents, grandparents who were never halachically converted. And so for the first time, they're really having to grapple with this issue, and he's been meeting with the commission for some time over the issue of what happens if somebody's been living a Haredi life and then discovers that it's not true.
But there, to me, it's a little bit easier because I imagine that person, they don't mind just going to the mikveh.
There's all other kinds of questions about of status and personal status.
If
they
have the problem of the
Well, if they're not Jews, then they're no mamzerim.
These are people who were nominally Jewish, who become Balei Tshuva,
yep.
And whose marriages have not been halachically sound. So all of a sudden, they're having all of these kinds of questions of personal status, and I'm just wondering whether or not having to grapple with these questions might eventually make for some more pragmatism about how you deal with those issues.
I hope. What I was trying to say, that I see the difference in that case. I think those are real problems. Just hold on one second. I think those are real problems, and they might be very painful for people. But the difference that I see there is if the people are already living a Haredi lifestyle, they'll feel less difficulty if they just say, okay, just dunk in this mikvah for a second, or do you accept mitzvot the way we do? Like, there's less of a conflict. It might force them to see the problems of the fragmentation of the Jewish people, but I would imagine there's less tension, but I'm not familiar with that world, so if you tell me otherwise, then I will believe.
Well, what I understood from him is question of being able to, people not wanting to marry the children of other people because of issues of personal status, so I just think this fragmentation is
affecting them as well. Yes. Yeah. I'll take one more question, and then people are free to leave, and I'm happy to speak to anyone else afterwards. Yeah.
You know, even if you're talking about the fragmentation of whatever, reform of rights, and so forgetting even people that are converting, just Jews that are already reform or Orthodox or conservative, whatever. I mean, I think it was this morning that I read in the paper that the United Torah Judaism whatever, MK, is threatening to bring down the coalition if they make a non-Orthodox prayer area at the Kotel. That's not even, that's before...
You're right. Meaning, so everything, yes.
You know, not forget conversion.
Right. So his voice, I think, is still very important in saying, let's have mutual respect for one another. Let's understand that other people are also functioning L'shem Shamayim in their understanding of Judaism, that they're working, and understanding that they're working to preserve. And, right, I believe that the Reform Movement would say to you, I can't speak in their name, that their acceptance of intermarriage, that their acceptance of patrilineal descent is their way of keeping people in.
Right.
And not diluting, right? And so from their perspective, they are working just as hard to preserve the Jewish people as the Orthodox who are concerned with people's status. But we have to have mutual respect for one another to understand that. And you're right. Even on that level, we've broken down to very, very, very sad perspectives. There's a lot to say about it, but Yemir Tzashem, things will get better.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.